Hello and welcome to Fresh Growth, Approaches to a More Sustainable Future. This podcast will introduce farmers and ranchers from around the West who embrace innovative, sustainable practices to enrich the natural resources we all care about. These successful, multi-generational operations experiment with new ideas and are making it pay. Listen in as they tell their story and provide advice for young or beginning farmers. In our second episode, Greg Jaguar of Matchbook Winery talks about farming 2,000 acres of grapes and olives in Yolo County, California. His multi-generational farm preserves wetlands and other natural habitat for wildlife, and Greg has installed dozens of owl boxes as part of a research project on rodent control. His farm uses integrated pest management and other sustainable practices such as cover crops, double drip systems, and composting. You'll hear his ideas for more holistic approaches to farming and how he tests his ideas, all while striving to produce the best quality wines.
Hello, and welcome to Fresh Growth, a podcast by the Western SARE program. That's Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education. I'm your host, Stacey Clary, alongside co-host Steve Elliott.
Thanks. Just for background, Western SARE is funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Institute of Food and Agriculture to promote sustainable farming and ranching across the American West through research, education, and communication efforts like this podcast. Today's guest is Greg Jaguar, the Director of Vineyard Operations at Matchbook Wines. He's a fifth-generation farmer in Yolo County and the son and nephew of the winery's co-founding brothers. Greg, welcome, and thanks for sitting down with us.
Hello, Steve. Hello, Stacy. Thank you for having me.
Greg, why don't you tell folks where we are and what it's like here?
We are in the tasting room at Matchbook Winery. It is just west of the town of Zamora in the northwest corner of Yolo County, and we are sitting in the conference room, tasting room, so there might be some background noise, as I told them. And so here we are. Yeah.
And your family's been farming here for a long time. Can you tell us some about that history?
So my family has been farming in this area. This property was purchased in around 2001. So we were just down the road at a winery called R.H. Phillips. And that was a family heritage named after my dad and my uncle's grandfather, who was a dry farm wheat farmer in Washington State. And he, as far as I know, did not consume alcohol. He was a teetotaler, a very successful farmer. And so a lot of that heritage and his talents and know-how came into the farming and has passed down through the generations. And so, as it said, farming is a gamble. So that is a constant way of life, and to think about the risks and rewards. And so it leads into generational kind of farming, because you do want to try new things and go places, and to say that we've tried that and it failed, and you kind of run up against these. So you learn to try different things and work inside budgets and parameters like that. And so it's exciting. It's a lot of fun. It's dirty work, hot work, where we are. We are right now in a winter that is probably one of the wettest winters, going back to my father saying he does not recall winter growing grapes this wet. And so there's some challenges that are going to come with that. And we look forward to that. A lot of benefits from that are reducing salts and getting the flushing and that infiltration going out. So that plays a lot into cover crops and holding the soils together. And here we are. So, yeah.
So what was your involvement growing up here? And tell me about the name of the winery, too, because I know there's a story behind that.
Yeah, the name Matchbook is an interesting way to sort of give a mind's image of what this area is. Very dry, hot area in the summers. And so there was, history that the stories came, I grew up hearing of matches and fires and rockets being launched as kids. And there was the best story was that I've heard through the years was that my grandfather took my dad and his two of his brothers, at least, to the sheriff's office and left them there for a few hours because he just couldn't contain them, and they were out doing that kind of stuff. And so my oldest uncle was part of a rocket club. And so my uncle's the youngest of those boys, probably 8 years younger or so. I could be wrong on that. But so they had a rocket club, and they they got into some interesting stories with the matchbook name came around. So on the website, it goes into a story, says, you know, a boy once played with matches, and it goes into that.
So, then, so they burned a few things down.
Yeah, they burned a few things down. Yeah, so more than they probably want to admit, you know, that I hear. So they had a great upbringing and a great heritage of farming. I grew up in the same place that they did and have been around these hills. And so I when I got into out of high school, I thought of Wine Grapes was just a hot place that wasn't a lot of fun and exciting. I got into college and saw that the wine industry was – there was a lot to the wine industry that I thought was – that I never had really seen. And so there's a whole other side to it. And that's kind of where we are today. And so that coming up and seeing things that weren't done correctly, going way back, you know, I mean, it's like reading about the Dust Bowl in the Midwest and the Great Depression, and hearing what people didn't understand about tillage and what people didn't understand about cover crops and these stories and this heritage and, RCD groups, you know, the Natural Resource Conservation Service that came out of that and was developed to see that there's this need to understand how to farm sustainably. And so it's a buzzword, it's out there, marketing loves to pick it up and stuff, but it's really kind of what we live. And so there's challenges within those because budget wise and keeping things economically sustainable. So it was a part of those that everybody faces that is farming. So a lot of the sustainability really is practical. It comes out of being sustainable in an economic way also. So, you know, because IPM, Integrated Pest Management, does allow you to not have pests blow up, and you can not overuse chemicals and create resistance and these kind of things. So a little bit further down, we were going to talk about that, but that's kind of what goes into some of these mistakes that were made because grapes were a new crop for my dad and my uncle. And so, you know, they were told you couldn't, you know, and that was kind of a joke of mine is, you know, tell somebody who's ambitious, like my family, they can't do it, and it's probably guaranteed it's going to be done, you know, to some extent. So
did people tell them they couldn't grow grapes here?
You know, it was never that grapes wouldn't grow, but it's not going to make anything special. And the big thing was that you can't grow reds where we are because it's too hot, and that was always the thing. And we found success over years trying different varieties, and it took a lot of trial and error. So this is kind of the phase two of this. So, you know, they grew and you kind of go with the market trends and what's popular. Chardonnay is a grape that does exceptionally well. It expresses fruit flavors, tropical banana. You get into these things, very ripe flavors, which is completely opposite of the old world style. So you go into Burgundies and things. So all oak fermented. And so it's really exciting how we do that. So we can do some really special things. And some of the reds that we're growing, Petit Verdot, Petit Syrah, Tempranillo, and Cabernet Sauvignon is actually proving out very well. So that goes more into the story of the soils, specifically where we are here, which wasn't by design when they started in the late 70s to say we're going to eventually move, you know, but how things evolved and progressed, we came to this property and purchased it and built this winery here. And so we're mostly a state grown, which means the brands, we do have one brand that is Sonoma grown and some Pinot Noir from Central Coast, but primarily we grow all the grapes here. So the bottles will say estate, and that's a pride to that we're doing these things. There's the farming heritage, we learned about things, and then going forward. So that's where we are.
Ian, you talked a lot about the different varietals. Are there other crops that you grow here?
We do grow olives for fresh California olive oil. We have 270 acres planted and just over 1,600 acres of wine grapes. So it's fairly large operation, nearly to 2,000 acres that we're farming here. So, and then the way this property is laid out, there's quite a bit of wetlands that are called. So, you know, the term that I've learned is biological compensation areas. You know, it's a very more technical term to say that you're setting land aside to have habitat for natural you know, predators and things that we can, that'll be part of the ecosystem here.
I'm sorry, what are some of the species that you'll see around here, the natural wildlife?
You know, these hills, there's not a lot of trees, obviously. It was never clear cut. There was not much on here. Where if you go down in the valley, there's a lot of the oaks and the valley oaks. But what we do have are black walnuts, cottonwoods, willows, tules and these things. And so there's natural wetlands on this property that have just tons of wildlife, birds, you name it, in them. And so that's part of the owl project, as we call it, but, you know, integrating that with owl boxes. And now we're moving forward on hawk perches and getting more of these, you know, using that area more for habitat. You know, there's some wild blackberry bushes, which is unique to this property. You don't see it much else anywhere around. Right across the winery, as you see, there's a big patch of that. And so there's just these natural vernal pools, these springs that come up here. And so we're utilizing some of that for a lot of just open grassland. You know, this was herding was the main thing and some dry farm, but it wasn't ever thought of. It was always thought of to be the lower quality soils, you know, for farming and stuff. So it never was sought after as a place to farm and make very much profit. But wine grapes naturally fit well to that, these soils. Yeah.
So you've been talking quite a bit about sustainability, I mean, definitely the habitat land conservation. You touched on soil health, cover crops, mm-hmm. IPM. Can you give some specific examples of practices that you have changed or plan to change in regards to those sustainable practices?
Yeah. So these soils are considered highly erodible. And you, if you're in growing barley or if you're in an annual crop, you have to have a plan for erosion. And you're exempt if you're in permanent crop where we are. So we do quite a bit of cover cropping. And that was something that was found the hard way. When you get a year like this, even with everything we're doing, especially the roadways where the water finds a path, quite a bit of topsoil is lost. And you know, moderate amount of cover crop can really hold that together. So that's one of the biggest things. And then the amount of irrigation required to go on has been a challenge for things. So we've come to develop a double drip system. So we have a buried subterranean drip down every row, and so we can move water and have a larger root system. And so we can get a lot more out of the water. So there's less evaporation. So we actually favor the center buried drip during heat waves to try to get that water down there and not lose. Is pretty, when you're in a north wind, especially, there's the evapotranspiration is to a point where you're losing a lot of your water just to the atmosphere and you're not to get to the soil. And so these are some of the things that we've adapted. Some of the others are using cheap fertilizers, low cost, that are high salts, especially potassium fertilizers. And we found that builds chlorides and it builds salts basically in your soils, which then deteriorates your aggregates and your soil structure. And so cover cropping is a large part of building that. That up. So, you know, we're conventional farming, but using sustainable in that aspect. So we're not organic and going completely away. That's not something that would be practiced just on a practical point of view. But definitely the cover cropping has been one of the largest things. And then finding the fertilizers and the ways to use like compost. That's a regular practice. And lots of people who are looking sustainable go into using cover crops and using compost as a natural thing. It's kind of like the old tried and proven ways to do things are still some of the best tools you have, you know. So that's a big part of it. And then IPM, I don't know, like I said, I grew up and it's just natural to me, but that was something that was kind of new coming into the 80s and 90s is using the IPM practices. And so we do a lot of scouting. We spend a lot of time in the field. We are part of Lodi Rules, and so that requires written documents of field scouting, your notes, and then the action plan that you take from that. So there's a lot that goes into, you know, you look at the notes that you've taken and the plan, but there's multiple hours that go into just getting to that point, you know. And so
explain quickly what Lodi Rules are.
So Lodi Rules is a voluntary program that you put yourself into, and it's a third party organization that then certifies you as sustainable. And so you have a seal that goes with your growing, and you get certificates. And so there's not a lot to it. You know, you could try to market it in some way, but it's not really the reason that we do it. It's more of being part of a grower community, because we sell to several wineries, and they like to use that, and so it's a promotional thing. So, and we do most of it without being certified, but that gives it, I guess, just credibility that, you know, it puts a stamp that we are doing it. You know,
it's a third party verifier that says you're actually doing something good.
Right, Lodi rules, and then they use Protected Harvest to do that, and so they're great to work with. They have about 1,000 different growers around, actually in other countries now, so it's grown quite a bit. California rules, because we're not in Lodi, but we jumped on with them, and instead of creating our own thing here, we were able to use all of what they did. So, and it's really very very low cost. What I think is $4 an acre that you pay into everything that they do, and then you have all of the support and everything from them. And so there's quite a bit of research and stuff. They've done a lot of work. So it's a really, really well put together program. It does take some more work on our end, but then it also, I think, keeps you focused on sustainability. And so there, it does tie you into a box a little bit about the products you can use and the amount, you know, if it's fungicides or insecticides and herbicides, these kind of things. So yeah, it's a good program for sure.
So you've mentioned quite a few things you've been successful with. Are there some ideas that you're kicking around that you're thinking about implementing anytime soon?
Yeah, I think some of the main things that we're trying are some of these non-conventional, you know, fertilizers aren't the right term, but more holistic approach. So different products that will work with the soils and to make the compost more effective, and so to create the humic acids and these, you know, these things that you hear about, but really building the soils through that way. So that's kind of what we're working towards, is how do we make a vine that has better nutritional value to it. And so, you know, when you get into wine quality and even the olives and the quality of the oil, these things are harder to quantify than just tonnage. And so these things are, you know, looking at tissue samples and soil samples. And so that's some of the things that we're implementing quite a bit more. And then organic material, bringing that in is essentially, you know, cover cropping is one of the best ways to do that. And so we're working with some of those different products that, you know, we can do that will emphasize these kind of things. So there's things you can apply in the drip system that will go to work in the soils, and the bugs in the ground will consume them, and then, you know, work to enhance your soils in a way. So
how are you testing some of this? I mean, you're not trying it on 2,000 acres, I assume.
No, we're doing we're trying to move forward in some of our reserve or higher end estate vineyards. We're doing this work in those vineyards. We're really looking at the tissue samples to qualify that, and the wine quality is where we'd like to go, and that's a much longer way to try to see the results you're getting from the input. So we're working with our winemakers together and have a collaboration going with that. And so we're you know, just looking at different blocks where we can do these things, and then how the wine makes, you know, how does it play into the wine quality in the long term. And so, but then in the short term, the health of the soils, the health of the vines, you know, we look at chlorides in the soil quite a bit. That's one indicator of the salts that are adding into them. So it really is a challenge. It is. It's very much so, you know, and so with weed pressures and things and herbicides, you know, so we're putting chemicals in and trying to leave some sections out that are going to go into these wine brands, and then hopefully make a higher tier wine and see if some of these benefits will come. You know, and there's a lot of pioneers that have worked these through in California that have worked with cover crops and have proven, and we're trying to find the different ones that work for your soil. And you have to find, when you talk about cover crops, there's so many different approaches to go, and you have to find the ones that work for your soils. It's a challenge to do it, because of you can plant these things in the fall and they may not come up. So we're trying to use best practice or smart. We're trying to be smart about it, and in that sense. So, you know, that's part of the process of learning and developing. There's got to be some failure, and so it's interesting all along. So if we care to go out after, we can look at some of the cover crops that are coming up, and you know, we have just different challenges, and I could explain why we came to those. But it gets, you know, yeah.
What have been some of them? What are you using? What have you given up on?
Yeah, well, some of the real tall growing cover crops, and this is something you'll hear from vineyards, and if you've ever seen pictures of mustard and it's taller than the vines themselves. Well, then if you can't get into the vineyard, they essentially create one issue, and this is not exclusively, but frost is an issue in the spring. So it's about airflow. So if you have a large cover crop, you can picture it becomes an air dam, as we call it. So it dams the air and prevents it from flowing out of the vineyard, and that can create pockets of frost issues. And so we have to have something that doesn't grow so tall, and then we have to get in and mow it or incorporate it. So right now, the one that is showing to be the best for us is it's about 60% barley and peas. And then there's vetch and clovers, crimson clovers, and then that's dwarf rape, like 8% or something like that. So we have it broken down. And those are custom ordered kind of things. So, you know, it took a different trying. So the bell beans are one that are great for giving you a lot of organic material, but they grow very tall. You know, they can grow as much as 6 feet tall. So on a year like this, we essentially cannot get into the fields. You know, you can drive on the tops where it's gravelly. We have very, and there's another challenge to farm is the bottoms are heavier clay soils and the hilltops are very gravelly. And soils here are highly eroded, as I mentioned before. So they are the end results of millennia of all of the good soil washing away from here and how they were developed. We're actually looking into telling that story of how the soils came here. And you see these river rock that are in the tops of the hills, and somehow there's washouts and things you can see as it goes down. And so how did they get deposited here? Where did they come from? It's something that we're working with. We're talking with a UC Davis soil scientist who's actually got a hold of him recently, but he's in Chile until the end of the month. So I emailed him, it was really cool. And this is the connection with the wines and stuff, but he emailed back and said, we love Matchbook. We bring visitors from out of town out there, and I'd love to come and visit. And, you know, so I was kind of thinking, oh, you know, I wasn't going to get very far with that because I'd gotten his name from somebody else. And it was just so neat to say, you know, wine kind of brings people together. And so I love doing it. I couldn't see doing anything else. And I really get into it, almost emotional about healthy soils, building these things. And I try not to get a little more carried away. My dad is not like that at all. I mean, we are different in a lot of ways. He'd admit that. But, you know, the more you think about that, when you have generational things, you have different focuses and interests. And so you can be more diverse and dynamic in your way that you approach, because the conversation, let's call it, the arguments that you have do bring out the strengths and weaknesses of going. So you can't just go one direction, but go out of business. And you can't, you know, just be extreme and try to, we're going to talk about monoculture as we go along, but, you know, realizing that you can't just be one way or the other and just sterilize the place, because essentially is the way I think about it is the grapevines become the only food source out here in these dry hills. And so ants and the mealybugs, if you're in the history of that, you got to give them credit, because they are little farmers and they farm these mealybugs, and they're like us doing what we do. And so they're doing it to the grapevines, and they have learned how to draw the sap from the grapevines, and it causes all kinds of mess with sooty mold and messes with the grapes and these things. So life is so diverse, you know, and it's just amazing. I do it because, you know, when every biologist you talk to them, everywhere you look, you find life on the planet, you know. So that it's just a living structure, you know. The soils are, and that's the philosophy I look at it, is the soils are a living organism, just like anything. So they need to be healthy, they need to be fed, and yeah.
So you're talking about biodiversity in essentially a monoculture operation. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the work that you've been doing with university researchers with the barn owls?
Yeah, and that was something I inherited and walked into through. So if we back up, I was gone for 7 years in Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington, and a winemaker that was here's wife was working and had a grant to work with an owl project. So they have a 3-year ongoing study of rodenticides, as far as I know. And then you'd have to ask them all the technicalities of it. But so I'm working with students from from UC Davis currently, and we have 40 owl boxes on site. And so this has been a huge learning experience for me, and I saw it, and I've been here about a year and a half now. I've been back, and so saw that, and we're going that direction, and a lot of growers have gone that way. So we have the boxes on site, and there's a way to do it. There's a lot of proven things that people have made mistakes on where to put them and the height of them, and there's all these little details of it. So about every owl box that we looked in had several young owls that were hatched in them, and it wasn't just a few, it was every one of them. It was just amazing. And being out at night and watching the owls hunt and move around, so gophers and voles and these things, we've seen years where mice are so bad that loads are threatened to be rejected by wineries. A lot of it was our own, so it's kind of in-house, we don't reject, but we could have mice and they hear the harvesters coming and they run up into the canopy to escape it, and they get taken into the fruit. And these are issues when they, like anything else, the rodents and everything are fine until they get to a population that become an issue. And so the integrated pest management is such a good approach to it, because it takes care of these things on a non-poison kind of way. And so we're working with them, and they haven't asked us to change anything. These are the students we're working with. And so we are using some rodenticides. And so their study is to find if they are making it into the owls, or if they're having anything as far as detriment to the owl populations. And so we're progressing into hawks and perches, and the populations around here, the red-tailed hawks. And so I'm learning a lot more about this, but they're quite a lot of high numbers, populations of them. So it's very encouraging for the ground squirrels. And like I said, these things are only an issue if they get to the numbers that become I guess economically an issue. So,
I've talked to those study authors, and they're not, just for clarity, they're not looking to see if rodenticides are bad for owls to say farmers can't use rodenticides. Yeah. They're looking at ways that growers can do both. How can you integrate using the biocontrol that the owls provide, but knowing more about where they hunt, when they hunt, when they're most active, and then put your rodenticides out when you have a population flare-up of voles or gophers.
That's right, yeah.
So that they don't hurt the owls.
Very well said on that. Yeah, and that's why I made the point, is they haven't asked us to do anything different. They want to work within our normal farming practices and go about that. So, we have seen reduction in numbers and the amount of poison that's going out. And so I think that's successful from that point of view. And
have you seen any owls with backpacks on them yet? Yeah. That they're going to put the little GPS collars on?
No,
them?
I haven't. Yeah. Okay.
Be on the lookout for little backpack owls.
I will do that. Yeah. Sustainability has so many different aspects. You guys know it just goes into so many different ways that we're looking at it. We're reducing water usage, which is, and another exciting thing we're doing is we're going to install a 4.5-acre solar farm this year. So that's going to take a lot of our pumping costs, and then you have to deal with PG&E and all these things. So there's so many structural things that are challenged to get in, and you have to get with PG&E, and that takes time, and you have to upgrade your transformers, and you have to do all this work and find the right site and find all these things. So I think that's something exciting. Since I've been back, that's what we've been working on, and they were already talking to some companies, and so we're going into the second full year of talking, and we finally are going to have it go in, and they say it may go in this late fall, as best they can do. That's just how long it takes, so, and then we're just getting the site selected, and we might have to remove some grapes, so there's another challenge to do it,
what percentage of the energy that your farm uses would it provide?
It's gonna offset. So the way PG&E works, you sell it back to them, and you don't use your own power. It goes into the grid. And so, but essentially the pumping side of it, it's under one megawatt or, million kilowatts of power. I probably said that wrong, but, and so essentially our pumping costs will be covered. And then the winery uses a lot of energy too here. So that's, you know, these are, there's a big capital investments to go into it. So when you're building a winery and you're building things, capital is a resource that is tight. And so to be able to say in 10 years you will see savings is hard to say when you're trying to put buildings in. But the refrigeration in these buildings is probably one of the biggest things. So they're all kept at a certain temperature and monitored year round. And so I don't know. I would say that our pumping costs will be essentially covered by that system. And so that's kind of exciting to think. And again, that's more of an economic decision than anything else. And you know, seeing where PG&E is going and everything happening, it just makes so much sense. I mean, it'd be dumb not to have. And I've seen it very much in the last several years is next to wells and next and on farms, you see solar going in. So it makes a lot more sense.
Right. Yeah. You're making a lot of investment of capital, a lot of investment in time in what you're doing here on your operation. Overall, you feel like it's making you more economically sustainable as well. Your bottom line, it's okay with the changes you're making.
Yeah. Yeah. These things are, I mean, when you look around and trying to save money, that was one that was a pretty easy decision with the way the costs have been going up for power. And so I think these things are, you know, those are the ones that make a big impact, you know. And so everything is going up cost-wise across the board. We're all feeling that. And so we have to figure out ways we can cut costs. And, you know, so a lot of that is knowing what you're dealing with in your vineyards or your farm, you know. And so anybody I would give advice to is know your soils, know your farm, know what you're up against, know your thresholds, and know where that is if it's from mildew or if it's from insects or weeds. And, you know, and then also as part of that is talking to the generations before you, talking to neighbors and listening to them. And don't always have to make your own mistakes, you know, and sometimes it pays to listen to somebody else and go along that way. I mean, it's amazing human nature. It's just, you can tell somebody you're going to fall off a cliff and people have to see it for themselves sometimes. I'm no exception to that. So
how do you balance that? Because I think that's one of the most fascinating things, especially for, you know, next generation business owners in farming or not, is how do you take the wisdom from the people who have done this and move the operation forward? Because you're going to do different things because things have changed. And the way that they used to manage isn't necessarily the way you want to manage.
Absolutely.
So how do you pick and choose and how do you push back and find a way?
Yeah, that's a good question. And not only are we moving forward into the future, which is uncertain, and so we're trying to make the best guesses we can from the past. And so I know personally, as I get older, it's that old adage is like, as I got older, I realized how much my dad, you know, he didn't know much when I was young, but he learned a lot as I got older kind of thing. So, you know, you just have to, you know, to look at it from, you know, from a bigger picture and maturity. And I like to approach things in that sense of, where do we want to get goal oriented? And that's the key to any business is have your goals clearly cut out, you know, and a lot of businesses, or I can't speak to them, but it seems to be like our goal is to make money, you know? And so that's such an unclear kind of goal, because are we here to make short-term money? And part of Lodi rules, which is interesting, to think about, they emphasize is a succession plan. And so for a farm to be able to talk about, and not necessarily the next generation, because it could be a corporate farm or whatever, but any should have that plan of where's the next, are we going to sell this, or is the next generation going to take over? So, and this, I think this is a pretty universal thinking to people who farm, is we want to leave it better than we found it. And, you know, I do look back at, you know, the old farmers who didn't care and the pesticides were thrown around and they just kind of, but that's kind of an old way to look at it. And I think that era is gone for lots of reasons because it didn't work. It wasn't long-term, but that was an interesting thing, was a succession plan and looking at the next generation, no matter who that is. And so, you know, my kids coming up, if they are interested, and I've learned to not try to make them come out and work, you know, when they're young and stuff.
Cause it's hot, dry, and dusty.
And I ended up really almost just went a whole different direction, you know, and, And I would have regretted that. So, but it is a lot of hard work. And so that those are the things. There's the things that don't change, and there's the hard work and these things that you think, yeah, we don't have to work this hard, and we have to do these kind of things. But those are the, when I go back to the generations, that's what came from them, that there aren't shortcuts and things, but you have to be smart about it. You have to be open-minded. We know there's going to be heat, and we know these things are going to happen. How do we adapt? How do we make the goals that we've set up happen?
Well, you've had a lot of different pieces of advice sprinkled through as you've been talking. If you were to address a beginning farmer, a new generation farmer now, what would you say is like the number one thing he or she should think about?
That is a good question. So, you know, I would think, first, is this something you really want to do? I mean, it's a lifestyle farming. You're not going to take a lot of vacations and be just the realities, these things. I mean, you do see exceptions to that. Know where, what you're doing, what you're getting into, and the challenges of it. And then, you know, I'd say, where do you want to go with your farm? What do you want to do? Who are your customers? Back to the goal-oriented. These things, the models are out there in life, the ones that have succeeded, the ones that have failed. We're always changing. We're always doing these things. But I think some of the biggest advice would be, don't look for the quick return and look at the long term. There's so much to be said for leaving areas out that are marginal. Allow for nature to work within. And I love hearing stories of growers, if it's rice growers they're probably one of the most visible, sustainable and work in natural settings, because they have the wild life that come in and the wild birds. And so they don't burn as much and they don't do these things. But, look at what you want to do in the long term. And I think those are some of the goals to look at. Use technology for the tool that it is. And you gotta be smart, and you gotta be on it, So, it's a tough thing to be in. You look at growing grapes, and in some aspects people, look at it and it has its romance and it has its stuff. But, we have interns that come out, and I've learned this is kind of going back to, like, young people want to get into it. Just kind of part of it is, are you scared of spiders? I've had somebody quit because they were deathly, and I didn't think to ask that. Well, you get out there and you have these days where you're just, tractors come out, people come out of the, and they're just covered in spider webs, and you get them down your back, and you just have to deal with it. And they're dust and dirt. And, so it's sun, it's hot and everything. And I enjoy that. Getting on a quad or walking the vineyards. And it's like, I luckily love that, because I don't like office time. I don't, as much in paperwork. And so I truly enjoy that side of it. And then to be able to have a product that we're making ourselves is just, I think, and I had to go out in the world and kind of see, and to see what I had. And so, you have to weigh you have to put your values out there, what you value and what you want. I kind of have issues with corporate farms and investors and hedge funds that come in, because they're looking for the return. They're in the money industry, So right. We're in the wine industry. There's no doubt we want to make money and we do it. I mean, we all enjoy a nice life for what we do. But, it's a challenge, a strain on your family. I mean, you have to, if you're in as young people, don't be naive of what it is with your partner and the amount of sacrifice that it takes to do that. I look at generations, my parents, they've been married for almost 50 years and they've stayed together. It's just a testament to a commitment to it and what it takes. And so those are some of the things I didn't really think much about going into it, but you just kind of assume this is the life, you understand it and you get into it, and it doesn't end at 5 o'clock. It doesn't, it's always going. You're always thinking about it. And in being in agriculture, there is no limit to the amount of work to be doing. It's just the limit to your imagination, because there's always more you can do. There's right. always more things. And my interests are in the sustainability and the habitats, these biological compensation areas. And so this property is really special because it naturally has wetlands and things that weren't plantable. And so I think they would have pushed further into those areas as much as possible. So we'll take it for what it is. It has these natural aspects to it, and so we're going to utilize those as much as we can as a tool, and to have, you know, have the habitat. There's some hunting benefits from that. You know, we have wild turkeys out here, and they start eating the grapes, and their numbers get, they will populate those things like big time. And so coyotes are always an issue, and everything. So it just, you know, you could go 24 hours a day, you know, if you had to. So you have to have a life balance. And so going back to a young farmer is, think about the life balance, think about these things, your family and what you want to have, who you're working for, the company you're working for, and good luck, you know. So
great advice.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it was great advice. And we're sitting here, it's an incredibly beautiful area. You've really shared your passion for sustainability, the respect for the land. You seem to enjoy what you are doing. You are working hard, mm-hmm. and you're producing some great wines.
That's the actually exciting part about it, that the wines that are coming, for sure.
Well, that's fantastic. And thank you for taking some time out and being indoors on a not raining day this spring.
Yeah, and we can taste some of these wines if you guys are open to it, so... Yeah,
definitely.
We are open to it.
Yeah.
So thanks again, Greg, and join us next time.
Thank you.